Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
Finally, nurses in Massachusetts reach a deal to end a strike going 285 days. Meanwhile, the U.S. Labor Department fighting for collective bargaining in Central America. And today on the show, the latest from the Ohio Federation of Teachers and the organization Good Jobs First. Welcome to the Tuesday, December 21st edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and the platform known as Stitcher. Another salute here, in case you missed it. The Writers Guild of America East broke the news just about a week and a half ago that a clear majority of workers at the iHeart Podcast Network, which you just heard me say, America's Workforce, is carried on, and it's the fastest growing division of iHeartMedia, sign union cards to organize with the Writers Guild of America, saluting those at iHeart Radio Podcast. All right, two guests on the show today. Melissa Cropper is going to be joining us. She's one of our regulars, Ohio Federation of Teachers. She is president of that organization. And just to fill you in, the OFT is composed of 54 local unions representing 20,000 members who are active and retired public school teachers, charter school teachers, school support staff, higher education faculty staff, public employees, Cleveland Alliance for Charter Teachers, Local 6570, representing educators and staff at seven Cleveland area charter schools. First thing we're going to talk about today is Menlo Park Academy and the union busting going on at this charter school, K through 8 charter school that serves gifted students, has been using public education funds, our tax dollars, to engage in a union busting campaign. Here's the crazy thing. This campaign, which includes anti-union literature and frivolous legal challenges, all intended to delay the election, began shortly after 96% of eligible employees supported forming the union. That's pretty close to unanimous. Unbelievable. That's our first story. Second story deals with mental health and violence in our schools. This year has been very challenging, extremely challenging for students, for parents, for teachers, all because we've seen an increasing amount of violence, vandalism, and behavioral problems in our schools. Melissa says the schools need to work on addressing the root causes of these problems and doing the long-term work needed to build better schools. Now, part of that focus, and she's going to get into some detail on this, is what's called social-emotional learning, SEL, so that students have the mental health resources and the emotional intelligence needed to succeed in these times. Lastly, community learning centers. And we've talked about this in previous shows with Melissa. This is another solution to some of the root causes of the problems we're facing in the schools this year, and she'll give us some details on that. So Melissa Cropper is going to be our first guest. Later in the show, Greg Leroy, who heads a wonderful organization called Good Jobs First, been on the show a number of times. They've been around since 1998, based in Washington, D.C. They are a nonprofit, nonpartisan resource center promoting government and corporate accountability. Best way I can describe them, they follow the money. Sometimes wonder, where did the money go? What we're going to talk about first is COVID relief funds. Most states most states are failing to provide a full and complete picture of how they've been spending billions of dollars of assistance provided by Congress to help their residents recover from the COVID-19 pandemic and all the financial burdens that happen. Greg reports just six states do it well. Alabama, Georgia, Illinois, Massachusetts, Michigan, and Wyoming. Eight states, even the District of Columbia, fail to disclose any meaningful information online. This is all part of a review of the online disclosure practices of all 50 states, as they have spent a combined $111.8 billion. Now, most states have created websites and landing pages listing awardee names and allocations, but they often lack details, says Greg, on how awardees spent their funds. So, hey, so-and-so got $10 million. Okay, fine. Now we know. Where did the money go? He does such a great job on this. The other issue we're going to get into is Amazon, and Amazon has just been exploding. In fact, Greg told me yesterday they built 700 warehouses in America since the pandemic began almost 2 years ago. 700. I mean, this company has exploded, obviously, because you don't have to go out to shop and get sick. Here's the problem. A lot of communities pay the price. Last year, with little warning, a new Amazon delivery station brought the rumble of semi-trailer trucks and delivery fans to Chicago's Gage Park neighborhood. The warehouse is located within 1,500 feet of five schools. This is in a residential area where more than half the people living within a mile have low incomes, almost 90% are Hispanic, and the neighborhood is one of hundreds across the country, says Greg, where Amazon's recent expansion has introduced large commercial operations. Residents near the new warehouses say they face increased air pollution from all the trucks and vans, more dangerous streets for kids. I mean, schools are right there. And other quality of life issues like clogged traffic and noise 24/7. And apparently, the way Amazon works, they look for low-income neighborhoods to put their warehouses to attract people of color, to work in their warehouses. And a lot of the people that shop on Amazon live in better neighborhoods. Just amazing. That and more. Goodjobsfirst.org is a website you might want to go to. Well, here's the latest regarding the Build Back Better bill. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer vowed yesterday to hold a vote early next year on the roughly $2 trillion bill to overhaul the country's healthcare, education, climate, immigration, and tax laws. This is despite what Senator Joe Manchin said over the weekend, that he could not support Biden's signature legislation. By the way, he told Biden, the people in the White House, I don't know if he told Biden directly, 30 minutes before he went on Fox News to say he was voting no. So Schumer just wants to get everybody on the record, and perhaps by the time they take that vote, maybe they'll get him on board. Who knows? But the story that's circulating now, Manchin was heard in Congress saying that he didn't want, well, first of all, he didn't want so much money going out to people because, especially when it comes to the child tax credit, people spend that money on drugs instead of providing for their kids. He didn't elaborate on that. And now he's denying it. Maybe in West Virginia, I don't know. Nurses at St. Vincent Hospital in Worcester, Massachusetts have reached a tentative agreement to end their historic strike. 285 days long. The Massachusetts Nurses Association, which represents the 700 St. Vincent nurses, have been in negotiations with Tenet Healthcare for 2 years, with the final 2 weeks involving federal mediators and culminating in a tentative agreement during an in-person session led by U.S. Labor Secretary Marty Walsh. Both union and hospital officials credited the involvement of Walsh as helping to bridge the divide. How about that? Now, the details of the agreement have yet to be released, and the nurses will remain on the picket line until the final agreement is ratified, which may take several weeks. However, according to one local newspaper there, the Telegram and Gazette, union officials noted that the agreement will provide improvements in staffing, safety, health insurance, and for the striking nurses to return to their jobs, calling the agreement a tremendous victory for the nurses as well as for their patients and the greater community. This has been a struggle. We did several shows on this in the past 6 to 8 months. In fact, we had one of the organizers on the show talking to how ridiculous this was. And this is, again, Tenet Healthcare, multi-billion-dollar corporation that's just cutting costs and ultimately hurting the patients. Speaking of the U.S. Labor Department and Marty Walsh, they announced yesterday the award of a $5 million cooperative agreement to the American Center for International Labor Solidarity to improve workers' rights in agricultural supply chains in Honduras and Guatemala and the garment sector in El Salvador. Administered by the Department's Bureau of International Affairs, the project will prioritize underserved communities and include a focus on gender and racial equity to address the systemic violation of internationally recognized workers' rights in the agricultural and garment sectors, the maquila sectors. That's what they call the garment area. The American Center for International Labor Solidarity will work with existing workers' organizations in Central America to help them represent and advocate effectively for those workers. Project will educate workers at the grassroots level, help them exercise their rights, build organizational capacity, and help ensure worker-led participation in negotiations and dialogue. Now, this agreement is part of a more than $20 million commitment to promote respect and compliance with labor rights in the region and a component of the Biden-Harris administration's root causes of migration strategy. They figure if they help the workers there get a decent contracts, better wages, working conditions, you can follow me on that, then they'll stay there. They won't come to the United States for a better life. This includes increasing organizing and collective action for workers to exercise their rights, help worker organizations train, represent, and advocate for agricultural and maquila workers to garner better wages, job security, and improve engagement between workers and government officials. Project also includes legal support, advocacy, campaign planning, and dialogue exchanges between local workers' organizations. In Guatemala and Honduras, the project will target workers in the palm, banana, and melon sectors. While in El Salvador, they're going to target workers in the apparel factories. So we'll see what happens here. It's a good idea. All right, we have to break. Melissa Cropper, on behalf of the Ohio Federation of Teachers, coming up next.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
America's Workforce is being brought to you in part by the Communication Workers of America.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining,
atomic energy,
and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at BoydWatterson.com.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle is at AWF Union Podcast, AWF Union Podcast. Before we get to Melissa Cropper, I just want to mention that the Department of Labor has announced an extended compliance grace period for its vaccinate or test rule. Now, the rule, which was reinstated by a divided Sixth Circuit panel, had required that companies with at least 100 employees implement vaccinate or test policies by January 4th. Well, now, the companies will have until January 10th. And OSHA will not issue citations for violations for non-compliance with the testing requirement until the 9th of February, where it finds a company is exercising reasonable good faith efforts to come into compliance with the standard. The department clarified that the vaccination component of the rule does not currently require a booster shot, although a lot of people are getting them right now because of this new variant, the Omicron variant that is sweeping the nation. All right, let's go to our live line and join Melissa Cropper, longtime sponsor and contributor to America's Workforce. She's president of the Ohio Federation of Teachers, also secretary-treasurer of the Ohio AFL-CIO. Website for the teachers, oh.aft.org. Melissa Cropper, welcome back to the show. How are we doing today?
Doing well, thanks. It's always a pleasure to be on the show.
Always a pleasure having you. Hard to believe that the year's coming to an end, and it's still hard to believe that there's so many people that just don't like unions. My God. Tell me the story about Menlo Park Academy, charter school for gifted students. Teachers want to go union, but Menlo Park doesn't like that idea. Tell me the story, Melissa.
Right. Well, I think it's important to point out that there's a lot of people who do love unions, though. And we had 96% of the teachers at Menlo Park who said they want to form a union. They came together, organized, contacted us, and were very insistent that they wanted to move quickly on forming a union there and having their voices heard. Unfortunately, the Menlo Park administration is challenging us in court over jurisdiction over who should actually be overseeing the union election. So for the past 10 years, as we've been organizing charters, and we've organized seven of them in Ohio, we've had a court ruling that said they fall under NLRB because they're privately managed, even though they receive public dollars. Mm-hmm. And now Menlo Park administration is challenging that and saying that NLRB should not have jurisdiction, that it should fall under CERB, even though they're not willing to stipulate that if we file under CERB that they'll recognize the union. So, so in other words, they're going to fight us no matter which way we go. But we've had the court hearing. We're waiting for a decision. And in the meantime, our teachers there and teachers and staff there are adamant that they're going to continue to fight until they get a union.
Do they know the makeup of the NLRB right now, Melissa? Because, you know, things have changed in Washington.
This is purely a delay tactic. Purely a delay tactic. If we were filing under CERB, they would challenge it also. They're just trying to do everything they can to slow down this process and try to stop the union from organizing.
That's amazing. How long were they organizing over there at Menlo Park?
This has actually been a fairly quick turnaround. It's been a few months, but when they contacted us, they had over half of their staff show up to the first organizing meeting that we had, which is really unusual. And they quickly contacted all the members there. They've got between 50 and 60 people. And they quickly contacted everybody, got everybody on board. Again, to have 96% of people file a card, that is an incredibly, incredibly strong statement about the desire and urgency to organize.
In a short amount of time, too. That's that's pretty significant there.
Right.
And I'm reading, now they received $4 million. Is that Menlo Park alone, or is that just charter schools in general? $4 million in state funding for the school year? Is that right?
I believe that's correct, yes. So they are receiving public dollars, and I think it's, you know, it's really important to point out that it's public dollars that are being used to fight this union election. So, you know, even though teachers are... teachers and, you know, other support staff there are saying they want this union. Again, 96% of people, the management is using public dollars to slow that process down, fight it, and try to stop it.
Are they doing the captive audience meetings? What are you hearing from the teachers? I know they're spreading
They've sent out at least 2 mailings to people and have also been having some meetings trying to discourage them from organizing. But it actually, as it often does, has had the opposite impact on the people there. Again, they have been so strong from the beginning about wanting a union that these delay tactics, these letters, everything that the management is doing only serves to incentivize them to work harder to organize.
Well, at this point, let's drive people to your website. I see that you've set up an online action page for residents in the state of Ohio. It's case sensitive. It's all lowercase. So those of you listening, in fact, you know, we have a national audience. We're on 6 platforms now. I think it'd be great if the entire country rallies behind the teachers there. Obviously, they want a union, 96%. Come on. Just go to oh.aft.org and you can read more about Menlo Park Academy and what they're doing to teachers who want to go union. It's really sad, but very common, very common. Let's move on to mental health and violence in our schools. This is a really, really good topic to get into because it's also scary what's going on. And a lot of this is in conjunction with the pandemic. Talk to me about what's going on in Ohio schools.
Yes, I mean, I think we've talked a little bit about this before, but we just continue to hear really on a daily basis about incidences of violence or some kind of student health issue. Heard over the weekend, I don't want to say where or anything at this point in time, but heard over the weekend about an eighth grader who committed suicide over the weekend. Again, within the past month prior to this ridiculous TikTok challenge that was out, had at least 4 incidences of reports of schools shutting down because of threats of violence. And again, just hearing about things that are happening in the classroom that are above and beyond the normal stuff that we typically hear from year to year. And it's become quite concerning, obviously, and especially in a time when people are stressed anyway because of the past 2 years that we've lived through. And the shortages that we have of substitutes, teachers, bus drivers, et cetera, it's just creating a real crisis in our schools. So, you know, we're keep digging deeper and deeper into this problem, you know, trying to find solutions to what can we do to create better teaching and learning environments. And it typically, you know, comes back a lot of times to what we've been promoting for years, which is we need to have more services available to our students in schools. We need to bring, you know, all the community services that are provided, you know, mental health services, behavioral services, things that are funded by the state, although underfunded, we need to make them accessible to children and put them where children are, which is in our schools, like we've seen happen in Cincinnati, like we see happening in Cleveland with the Say Yes work. Mm-hmm. We need to amp up that work and make it just a regular part of every school system in Ohio.
Social-emotional learning centers. I know this is part of your focus. Can you give our audience a little detail on how those actually work, these SELs, as they're called?
Yes, I mean, SEL is a broad term that people interpret differently, unfortunately, based, you know, in our new political climate. But basically, what we talk about are just taking services such as, like I said, whether it's behavioral health, whether it's things like vision and dental, social workers, all these services that children need in order to take care of the stressors that are in their lives, making them, putting them in a school where they're accessible to children, and creating ways for children to be able to get that additional help. I mean, as educators, we all learn as we are going through our prep about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that, you know, children can't learn to their full ability until they've had and had their basic needs taken care of, whether that's hunger, so, you know, over the years we put breakfast and lunches in schools, or if it's some kind of health problem, vision, dental, other types of health problems. But increasingly it is more about mental health needs. So again, the pandemic created a lot of stress and trauma in children's lives. The angst in society around, you know, everything, around everything, it seems like all the polarization that's happened in society and the lack of resources that are available to people to deal with that anxiety, playing out in our classrooms, playing out in children. We need services in school, and we need professionals in schools who can deal with those issues and help children overcome those barriers so that teachers can do what they're trained to do, which is teach.
Mm-hmm. And these are services that are obviously funded by the government.
Right.
And you kind of indicated to me that they're underfunded right now. It's my understanding that Tim Ryan, who is a representative in the Mahoning mm-hmm. County area, now running for Senate, is behind what you're talking about right now. He's been talking to the Ohio Federation of Teachers about this.
Right. I mean, Congressman Ryan has been an advocate for these types of services for his entire career, really, back before it was, you know, even something a lot of people were talking about. But, you know, he long time ago saw the need for children to have these social emotional needs taken care of, and has been an advocate for getting these services in schools. He introduced the SELF Act, which is the Social Emotional Learning for Families, and has been a supporter of making sure that children have their basic physical and mental health needs taken care of. That's, I mean, that's one of the reasons why we recently supported him for endorsement for running for U.S. Senate. We just passed that endorsement last week. But his understanding of what happens in the classroom and the problems that children bring to schools, and his willingness to step up and fight for those resources for children, makes him a really strong candidate for us. In addition to the fact that he's just so incredibly pro-labor, and his opponents are so, so horrible on education issues.
Well, you're right about that. And he's all,
I mean, I like to lift up candidates because of their good qualities, which, you know, like I said, Congressman Ryan has so many good qualities. But my goodness, I mean, his opponents are like bottom of the barrel. So
I hear you.
Yeah.
What we're talking about here, and Melissa Cropper is joining us from the Ohio Federation of Teachers, we're talking about investing in our children, and this all segues into the community learning centers. You and I have talked about this before. I mean, obviously, mental health is an issue, especially with the pandemic, but beyond that, food, clothing, social services, internet access. I mean, loving kids. I mean, they're doing their homework in a McDonald's parking lot because they don't have internet access at home. I mean, we've got to do a better job, and it's my understanding, I guess, Randy Weingarten, the national president of the American Federation of Teachers, visited Cincinnati to tour what they're doing down there. Can you give us a rundown of this? I guess it's kind of an experiment down there that is working, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a program or a way of doing school that they've been doing since early 2000s, which, again, is taking resources that are available in the community, often publicly funded, but sometimes privately funded, too, and putting them where children have access to them. So, again, you know, oftentimes children live in neighborhoods where they can't easily go see a doctor, or there's not a mental health specialist close by, or, like I said, there's not internet access. So it's a matter of finding where those resources are, placing them in the school so that children can access them whenever they need it. You know, take internet access, like you mentioned. I mean, the story I like to tell often is about Euler School in Cincinnati, where you know, someone, one of the businesses down there offered to give every student in the district a laptop to help them out, which is a wonderful gesture. However, students didn't have internet access, couldn't afford internet access, so the laptop was useless. So instead, what the district, what the Community Learning Center concept did was say, in addition to giving these laptops, why don't you put hotspots around the city so that kids can access the internet? So that's what they did. They put up hotspots, put up towers on buildings and everything around the city so that kids could then access the internet. So that's kind of a broader example of what community learning centers can do. But that same school, Euler, also has like a dental clinic, a vision clinic, mental health specialists on site, child care facilities for children ages like starting with like 6 weeks up until they start school. It's every service that you could think of that children and families might need, and making them accessible. And so we see the same thing happening in Cleveland now with the Say Yes work in Cleveland. It's how do you find those services that are somewhere available out there that are being funded, but they're not being used because children can't get to them. Bringing them into the school where children can access it, and then getting the full benefit of what's already being funded.
Amazing. The money's there. They're just not being used properly. That's amazing.
Right.
Very simple, common sense things that can make a big difference, no doubt about it.
Right. All right, and it goes Melissa. Neighborhood by neighborhood. I'm sorry. So it's, I mean, get another example in Cincinnati is you know, you've got neighborhoods where you got, for example, a large Guatemalan community. So putting in a language lab for parents in the community to learn the language, to learn English, but also for the school to understand the needs of those types of families. So, yeah, it's a neighborhood-by-neighborhood concept that works really, really well.
Step by step. All right, Melissa, we're going to leave it on that note. Melissa Cropper, president of the Ohio Federation of Teachers. Main website is oh.aft.org. Go there. Check the Menlo Park Academy story, where 96% of the teachers there, eligible employees, want a union, and the school is fighting them tooth and nail. And you can help out. There's an online action for residents in the state of Ohio. Do check that out. Also, you can check out the Ohio Federation of Teachers on Facebook, OFT Union, and follow them on Twitter, OFT Advocate. Great show today. Thank you so much, Melissa. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you. Learned a
lot. And hopefully everybody's going to go to those websites, support those teachers, and much more. You take care. Best of the holiday season to you, your staff, your family. We'll talk to you in January, okay?
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, quick break. When we come back, Greg LeRoy has been following the money since 1998, and he's coming up next on behalf of Good Jobs First.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
The United Steelworkers of America represent over 70,000 workers in the state of Ohio. Steelworker members enjoy the benefits of some of the best contracts of any workers in the world. Many of your friends, neighbors, and relatives are members of one of the most effective democratic unions in our country. With the pressures unorganized workers are under in today's economy, you need to join them. So call the Steelworkers Organizing Office at 216-292-5683 or toll free at 1-800-443-3752.
The United Auto Workers are one of the largest and most diverse unions in North America, with members in virtually every sector of the economy. Learn more about this proud sponsor of our program at UAW.org.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And don't forget, we are available on 6 platforms now, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. And when you get an opportunity, just sign up and receive our shows on a regular basis and give us a rating. We always like those 5-star ratings. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the North Coast Labor Federation, all connected to the AFL-CIO. Let's go to line number 2. Welcome a dear friend, longtime contributor. Haven't heard from him in a while, although a couple of the people that work for him have been on the show. Greg Leroy is his name, and he heads Good Jobs First, goodjobsfirst.org, based in Washington, D.C., been around since 1998. And like I said, he follows the money, our money, taxpayer money. Hey, Greg, welcome back to the show. How are we doing today?
Great to be back with you, Flash. We're doing good.
Why don't you give us a recap of Good Jobs First? I mean, the last time you and I had a conversation, we didn't have so many platforms, podcasting. Why don't you explain
I can't keep up with your growth. Congratulations.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, talk to me about that part.
Sure. So, you know, we've been around, as you said, for 23 years, and we do watch the money. Some people would call it corporate welfare. Some people would call it business incentives or economic development subsidies. Take your pick, but it's real money. It's tens of billions of dollars a year that states and cities spend. And then sometimes we also have these special bursts of federal spending, like the Obama stimulus back in 09, 010, and now the CARES Act and the Rescue Plan Act coming from Uncle Sam, flowing through state and local governments for the economy. But often the money's not very well disclosed, and we're very big on sunshine, trying to make sure everybody knows where the money's going so they can make judgments about, you know, are their public officials really spending the money the way it needs to be spent, given the terrible things that have been going on with COVID and the economy.
Uh-huh. Talk to me about the CARES Act then. Now, apparently there's a lot of money that went out all across the country, and some states are doing well, others are not. What's the story here?
Yeah, so there's a provision of the CARES Act called the COVID Relief Fund, Coronavirus Relief Fund, and it's worth $150 billion to states, big cities and counties, tribal governments and territories. No state got less than $1.25 billion, so it's real money, even for smaller states' budgets. And the money, the spending guidelines are pretty loose. They basically said, you know, if you needed to spend new money because of the virus, it's eligible, which could be everything from medical supplies to, you know, bonus pay for essential public workers or infrastructure or, you know, hospital equipment. It's quite loose. So you'd hope that at least states would then tell everybody how they're spending the money. But the trouble is that the disclosure guidelines that came out from the Treasury Department were really quite loose. And so we only found six states out of 50 plus D.C. doing a good job, you know, actually telling people where the money went after the block grant went to the Department of Health and Human Services, or the block grant to the Department of Housing or Transportation. So we found some states that aren't even pretending to tell anybody. They don't even have any degree of disclosure that you can get any sense of what's going on. More than a dozen states fit that description. So, you know, and the good states are kind of an odd mix of red and blue and purple. You know, southern states like Alabama and Georgia, Wyoming, and then bluer or more purple states like Illinois and Massachusetts and Michigan. So it's not a partisan thing, and it's never been a partisan thing on sunshine. It's just some governments care enough to tell people where the money's going.
And others do not.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm reading here, Arizona, Kentucky, Maryland, Missouri, mm-hmm. Nevada, Oregon, Pennsylvania, and Virginia, as well as Washington, D.C. Now, that's a surprise. They have no sight at all. None at all.
Right. Right. Or next to nothing, and therefore you can't begin to get a clue about where the money's going. And therefore you can't make any judgments about your local and state elected officials.
So you mentioned the Treasury Department. Are they aware of the problem here that they've kind of created? If they weren't so loosey-goosey on all this thing, if they had, and I'm surprised by that, too. You would think when the federal government's going to dole out money, they would want some accountability, right?
Yes, you would hope so. I mean, you have to remember that the CARES Act was actually passed in the later days of the Trump administration, so it was the Trump Treasury Department that had first dibs on that, and you know, we know that, for example, the Rescue Plan Act, ARPA, or ARP Act, is better. It has a better template, and that was passed after Biden took office. So there is a demonstrable difference there. And we argue that if we can go back and now put the ARPA rules and attach that to the CARES Act money, people would have a better view of what's going on. Whether, to your original question, though, yes, the Treasury knows. We've been meeting with Treasury. We've been meeting with the Oversight Committee of PRAC. It's called the Pandemic Response Accountability Committee. They know. We've been griping at them for many months about this problem. And we did this study, frankly, to formalize our complaint to them because they didn't seem to be moving. So I think best case scenario probably realistically is that they do an aggressive job overseeing the ARPA money, and we in the nonprofit sector agitate more governors to do a better job with their CARES Act money.
So just to be clear here, you said, okay, Trump, when he had the CARES Act, there's certain rules in place just for the CARES Act. So those rules, when they come out with those rules, they apply only to that legislation, that bill that passed it. They're not like universal rules when the government doles out money then. Is that right?
There are some parameters. There are some guide rails, and there's certainly longstanding websites, disclosure websites like usaspending.gov. But yes, these are exceptional bills that don't get passed every year. These are not normal appropriations, and therefore they come with their own set of disclosure rules. That's right.
So this is all in a paper that came out from Good Jobs First. We're speaking with Greg LeRoy, who started this organization back in 98. Federal dollars, states' recoveries, how poorly most states are disclosing CARES Act spending. Greg, when did this come out? And I'm just wondering, because when the report came out, I would imagine a couple eyes opened on this whole thing, right?
it just came out on December 13th, so very recently.
Okay.
And yes, we hope that there's more attention now paid, in state capitals as well as Treasury. And we know, it's not the first time we've graded the states. We've actually been grading the states and naming and shaming, bad disclosure states since 2007. This is our, sixth or seventh report card study like this. And we know from things we hear from other states over time that some of them pay attention and some of them try to clean up their act. We can move the needle here. We will.
Yeah. Well, when you shame somebody, you would hope that they would clean up their act. But I guess there's a few that don't care. They said, hey, you know what? I don't know you. I'm not going to change what I'm doing. But hey, you know what? You got to do what you got to do. And a lot of this, I have to be honest here. You know what's changed in the media over the years? It's shrunk down to virtually nothing. And Greg, you're doing the job of an investigative reporter when it comes down to it. Do you realize that?
We do, and that's why we have so many hundreds and hundreds of journalists on our email list now, because we are filling a gap. We and many other nonprofit groups, some of them do call themselves reporting shops. There's more than 100 of them now around the states, many in state capitals, many formed by dislocated journalists. You can see the websites at inn.org. A lot of us are out here doing this. You're right.
All right, Greg, I got to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about how Amazon has expanded and hurt various communities in America. That's coming up next. We'll be back right after this.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as healthcare and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.
The AFL-CIO is a proud sponsor of America's Workforce Radio. United by efforts to raise wages, listeners to this show and workers all across America are beginning to turn a corner and drive the economic debate. The AFL-CIO is comprised of 12.5 million working people from 56 unions, but we stand with and fight for everyone who is working for a better life. For more information about our raising wages agenda, go to AFLCIO.org.
Union members need to be heard. Reliable and convenient union voting has never been more important than it is now. Make voting easy for your membership by working with survey and ballot systems. SBS offers encrypted and monitored solutions that ensure your elections are accurate and accessible for every member through mail-in, online, and in-person voting. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com and take the next step in getting secure and auditable elections.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle, AWF Union Podcast. Let's go back to our live line and rejoin Greg LeRoy on behalf of Good Jobs First, goodjobsfirst.org. Greg, one of the big topics you and I have talked about over the years, and they're always in the news, is Amazon and the growth of Amazon. It's extraordinary. I guess during the pandemic, they really exploded, and this explosion has had an impact on a number of communities. What are the numbers here, Greg? You know, before and after. Well, we're still in the pandemic, but before the pandemic and today, where are we?
Yeah. So on the eve of the pandemic in February of 2020, the company had 475 warehouses of different sizes and kinds around the country. And then since then, through November, you know, last month, next year and a half, essentially, the company added 775 more warehouses for a total of 1,250. And they've got another 80 more at least slated to open in the next 2 years. So, and they did that obviously as they gained huge amount of market share as people shopped more online to avoid the risk of the pandemic.
Sure.
But the trouble is, what they've also gotten this year alone, the company has gotten more than $669 million in taxpayer subsidies for some of those warehouses that we have enough disclosure on. And we've been saying for 5 years, we published our first study on this 5 years ago, the prime business model of faster and faster delivery, which they really started ramping up back in 2011, 2012, requires the company to have lots of warehouses close to affluent zip codes where most of the prime households are. They can't not do that. So why would we pay the company to do what it has to do? That's the problem.
And the communities are bending over backwards to bring them in. Now, apparently, they go into various neighborhoods. They do a lot of market research. You got to give them credit on that. And what's the explanation? How did they do that? Where did they go?
So we actually have a map, an interactive map, which we're about to refresh. But if you just go to goodjobsfirst.org/Amazon, there'll be a link to it, really easy to find. And you can look at your own communities and see. The pattern is this. They locate not far from the affluent zip codes, you know, usually within a 20-minute drive shed of the affluent zip codes, but they locate in more industrial areas or more blue-collar areas, you know, two or three exits out on the highway where the land prices are cheaper, but also where the neighborhood is more likely to be people of color and lower-income residents. So there's really an environmental justice, environmental racism issue here with those sightings. And then a huge amount of wasted taxpayer dollars subsidizing that pattern as well.
I guess in Chicago, and I'm reading this right from your website, the Gage Park neighborhood, they started a new warehouse there recently. Mm-hmm. And some people are kind of concerned because I guess schools are there and it's causing a lot of traffic jams. Can you fill in the details here?
Right. So you have to remember these warehouses are very high volume, and they've got both a lot of inbound trucks, and those are more often the traditional 18-wheelers, you know, big diesel belching semis, and then lots of trucks outbound, which are the smaller panel vans making the so-called last mile delivery, you know, to homes and businesses. So they are enormous traffic generators, enormous amounts of pollution and congestion. With these facilities, and that's the problem.
So are these neighborhood groups, there's got to be a number of them that are pushing back saying, wait a minute, maybe we did the wrong thing here, or is it having an effect on other locations that Amazon is trying to put a warehouse in?
Well, certainly there's been some successful blowback. Last year, a group of community activists in a little town called Grand Island, New York, which is an island in the Niagara River upstream from Niagara Falls, successfully defeated the siting of an Amazon, of a huge Amazon warehouse that was proposed for their island. And literally this evening, in a suburb of Pittsburgh, a place called Churchill, Pennsylvania, the borough council will take a final vote on whether or not to allow a 3 million square foot Amazon warehouse located across the street from two schools and in a short distance from 400 homes. Yes, there's a group called Churchill Future has been very actively pushing back on that project.
3 million square feet. Now, I assume they're looking for some tax breaks there as well. Is that right?
You know, oddly enough, the developer gave up a $10 million pot of funding. I think it was from the Allegheny County, if memory serves, early in the fight, because they realized that made the whole project even more vulnerable, more easy to criticize.
Yeah.
But if they get the permit that they're seeking, I'd be very surprised if there won't be other kinds of public support coming.
And again, that figure was $669 million that Amazon got in tax breaks to locate a warehouse. And they had to locate a warehouse anyway if they want to grow their business. It's money.
Since 2012, when Amazon created a tax break department, essentially, they've been getting more than 20 economic development subsidy packages per year. And vast majority of those are for warehouses. A few of them are for data centers and office buildings. But warehouses are the big dogs.
Crazy stuff. Crazy stuff. Yep. It's been going on a long time. You know, I remember the conversation we had with Foxconn, and I bring this up because I think they want to locate in Lordstown, Ohio, where they had produce the Chevy Cruze and the Cobalt.
Mm-hmm.
What happened here? Just refresh me. In Wisconsin, wasn't it like $3 billion in tax breaks or something that the former governor was giving them?
Right. Well, actually, it was $4.75 billion total subsidies in Wisconsin. This is when Scott Walker was governor, and it was the biggest package ever given to a foreign multinational. This was a deal that President Trump was very involved in, as well as Jared Kushner. That deal has really collapsed. It's been like a slow-motion train wreck ever since 2017. But the Lordstown connection is this. So having failed miserably in Wisconsin, Foxconn is now partnering with another company called Fisker to basically take over that GM plant in Lordstown and try to build electric cars. And the company called Lordstown Motors basically ran afoul of regulators and looks like it's going nowhere. And Foxconn's trying to sort of mop up the mess. But I'm just very dubious because this is a company with such a spotty track record here in the States.
Well, that begs another question here. How could a company like that has a bad track record go like state by state and try to get subsidies to create a business that may not even materialize? They're still trying then, right?
Yeah. Well, I have a theory. I mean, you know, and we know that the number of deals that states can compete for has really been depressed for a long time, not just having to do with the Great Recession or the pandemic recession. And it means that those deals that are still happening can command enormous price tags. The politicians are desperate for deals to take credit for because there aren't very many of them compared to, you know, 20 years ago. And a lot of people think that the reason there aren't enough deals is because we haven't had effective antitrust regulation of companies like Amazon and Google and, you know, the high-tech companies that have been gobbling everybody up. So, and yet here come the high-tech companies getting massive packages for their warehouses, for their data centers, for their campuses, for their headquarters. So it's a lot to do, I think, with antitrust regulation really screwing up the business landscape in this country.
Well, Greg, we are very, very fortunate to have you in the organization Good Jobs First. Again, all this is posted and more. Go to goodjobsfirst.org. You take care. I'm sure we'll be talking in the new year. You're always doing something that's very, very revealing. And again, we're talking about our money, taxpayer money. Follow the
Amen.
Money. You take care. Best of the holiday to you, your staff, and we'll talk, like I said, in 2022, all right?
Talk to you next year, Flash.
Love talking to that guy. Greg LeRoy, Executive Director of Good Jobs First, goodjobsfirst.org. And that's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up tomorrow, the latest from the Heat and Frost Insulators and the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. Until then, all of you, have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.